Your film is now ready to be shown.
Good morning. I'm Justin Hendricks, editor of Tech Policy Press, a nonprofit media venture intended to provoke new ideas, debate, and discussion at the intersection of technology and democracy. In a New York Times review, Columbia Law School professor and former White House official Tim Wu calls journalist Karen Howe's new book, Empire of AI, Dreams and Nightmares in Sam Altman's OpenAI, a, quote, corrective to tech journalism that rarely leaves Silicon Valley. Karen has appeared on this podcast before to help us understand how the business model of social media platforms incentivizes the deterioration of information ecosystems, the series of events around OpenAI CEO Sam Altman's abrupt firing in 2023, and the furor around the launch of DeepSeek last year. This week, I had the chance to speak with Karen about the book and what she imagines for the future.
My name is Karen Howe, and I am the author of Empire of AI.
Karen, I'm so excited to speak to you about this book. It is quite a tome. You say it is based on 300 interviews with around 260 people, correspondence, documents, 7 years of reporting at MIT Technology Review, The Wall Street Journal, The Atlantic. You spoke to 90 current and former OpenAI executives, 40 current and former executives, employees at Microsoft, Anthropic, Meta, Google DeepMind, and Scale AI. This was a piece of work. This is an accomplishment that goes beyond what most people would do in their career.
It definitely feels like the culmination of a lot of all of my work, I should say. It feels like everything that I've ever reported on up until this moment. And even pre my journalism career, everything that I experienced when I was working in tech, I feel like I poured all of that into the book. So yeah, it does feel like an accomplishment. I do feel proud of the work that I did to put that together.
Well, I'm catching you on the beginning of your American book tour. You write at the outset, this book is not a corporate book. While it tells the inside story of OpenAI, that story is meant to be a prism through which to see far beyond this one company. It is a profile of a scientific ambition turned into an aggressive, ideological, money-fueled quest, an examination of its multifaceted and expansive footprint, a meditation on power. When you first set out to write this book, did you know that's what it would become?
Absolutely. I mean, it's funny. When I first set out to write the book, I actually didn't know it would focus so much on OpenAI. I really wanted to first tell the story of how the AI industry was increasingly becoming a new form of empire. And I realized as I was mapping out how I would tell this story and make it feel real and concrete and have some kind of backbone to guide readers through this kind of epic decades-long journey that has culminated in this frenzy that we see in the last few years, I had to do it through OpenAI. And so I changed my plan for the book and was like, okay, in addition to reporting out the history and the impacts all around the world that I want people to see to really concretize what I mean when I say empire, I also need to do a lot of insider reporting to just map out what decisions were people making within this company that then had ripple effects that shaped the AI industry and the rest of the world.
So you say that this word empire is the metaphor through which you've come to understand AI and the AI industry, OpenAI. You talk of colonialism and exploitation. In the chapter Dreams of Modernity, you say you, quote, realized that the very revolution promising to bring everyone a better future was instead for people on the margins of society, reviving the darkest remnants of the past. I guess when you think about how you got to that point, when did that begin to dawn on you? That was the story you were writing.
This goes back to reporting that I did years ago for MIT Technology Review starting in 2019, when I started encountering lots of different examples of companies engaged in a very particular colonial or imperial mindset, where they would go to, like, a lot of companies from the global north would go to countries in the global south to either exploit labor because it was hidden away from their users and they could continue to perpetuate the narrative that AI was magic, or go to the global south to collect data because these are the environments that have less data privacy protections, There's just generally, if a company is found wrong, be doing something wrong, there are just less ramifications. And as I was trying to figure out, wait a minute, this is definitely a pattern. Like I was looking at how facial recognition companies were swarming into South Africa, for example, and using that opportunity to gather a lot of black face data, because at the time the industry was getting heavily criticized for the fact that their technologies were less accurate on dark-skinned individuals. And that process in and of itself was then leading to what scholars in South Africa were calling a digital apartheid, a recreation of apartheid, where there was a patrolling of black bodies that felt exactly the same way that the apartheid system also limited the freedom of movement for black people. And so those were the types of examples I kept seeing. And I was like, this builds up to a bigger picture. It's not just one-off stories. There's a broader global system of power that is causing these stories to happen again and again. And so I ended up writing a series called AI Colonialism that ended up publishing in 2021. And that was the first time that I concretized this thesis that a lot of the profit-driven incentives of the AI industry and the kind of exploitative nature and the very consumptive nature of AI technologies as they were being developed largely by Silicon Valley were perpetuating all of these colonial dynamics, imperial dynamics that we still live in the legacy of today.
You say OpenAI is now leading our acceleration towards this modern day colonial world order. When you think about that diagnosis, when you think about framing OpenAI, I suppose as a leader in this, what are the kind of key things that you would put at their door?
Yeah, I think maybe the best way to answer this question is to flesh out a little bit more of how my argument around empire has started to evolve since reporting this book. So originally, I pegged empire to the AI industry, but in the book, I peg it to actually, like, I call OpenAI an empire and each company their own empire, which I think is a bit of a important distinctional shift, in that one of the key features of empire building back in the day was creating this idea that you are morally superior than other empires. So you need to be an empire because there are other bad empires out there that are going to bring the world to a terrible place. So you must build yourself up and be strong and fortify yourself so that you can outcompete them. And, you know, this was like the British Empire would always say that they were better than the Dutch Empire. The French Empire would say they were better than the British Empire. And that was a core justification for why they were plundering resources and exploiting labor all around the world. And they also had this very inherent belief that they were doing all this under civilizing mission. They were truly bringing benefit to everyone and giving them the opportunity to actually ascend to heaven instead of go to hell. And that is essentially the dynamic that we see now within the AI industry, where all of these companies that I define as empires of AI, they're all trying to compete with each other with this kind of rhetoric of they alone are the ones with the scientific and moral clarity to bring people to heaven or else risk sending everyone to hell. And OpenAI really was the first company to essentially put a marker in the sand and turn it into a race. So before, DeepMind had been using the rhetoric of building artificial general intelligence as a motivation for why they existed, but they didn't approach this as a race and they didn't approach the quest for AGI as something that required an enormous amount of scale and enormous amount of resources. It was specifically OpenAI that fashioned itself as an anti-DeepMind, an anti-Google. We're going to be a nonprofit. We're going to be the good guys that bring this technology to everyone. And in order to do that, we're going to blow up these models, blow up the amount of data that we use to train them, blow up the amount of data centers and supercomputers that we need to train them, and do it aggressively such that we continue to stay in the leading position. And so that is what kicked off an entire industry-wide race where every single company, whether old ones like Google, Meta, have entered this race, or new ones have formed like Anthropic, Perplexity, that have all started rushing in this direction. And this escalation of the size, the scale, and the resource consumption is what I highlight in the book is truly the thing that is bringing us towards catastrophe. Like, we are returning to an age where the majority of the world now doesn't necessarily have rights anymore. Like, it is these companies and the people at the top that are deciding what goes and what doesn't go, what data they can take, and who gets to have privacy versus who doesn't, who gets to have economic opportunities and who doesn't. And everyone else lives in the thrash of their decisions and their competition.
Of late, OpenAI has really kind of put its shoulder into going out and trying to build connections with foreign governments. Of course, it's wrapped itself, I think, in the American flag. We should talk a little bit about that, the extent to which this is such an American project in many ways. But in just in the last week, we've seen Sam Altman over in the Middle East, along with Trump and other AI executives meeting with folks in Saudi and other places around settling a vision of artificial intelligence. We've seen OpenAI release this product or product line or a service proposition around quote unquote democratic AI. It's this all encompassing proposal really around, we're going to do everything for you. We're going to build AI for your government. We're going to help you establish a startup ecosystem around AI. We're going to bring capital. It seems like at this level, like OpenAI really is empire building or trying to insert itself into nations around the world.
Yeah, I loved your piece, by the way, talking about how OpenAI was wrapping itself around the American flag. I very much think they are, that is exactly right. And they are using this as a tactic to ferry themselves out further and further and get into higher and higher echelons of power to entrench their relevance and entrench their infrastructure and their approach in physical data centers that will not be, you cannot unwind them once they are built. And there's kind of this realization that I hit upon while I was reporting that I don't explicitly call out in the book, but there is an undertone throughout the book that the U.S. is also an empire. And I mean, scholars have long made this argument. Now it feels it's really hard to argue against with what's happening with the government now and the rhetoric that they now use to talk about taking over Greenland, taking over Canada and things like that. But we really are seeing the alliance of Silicon Valley empires that are corporate-based empires and the government as a state-based empire, both trying to use one another to fortify their empire. And this has a historical analog in that the British East India Company was a company that engaged in economic activity and generally mutually economic activity around the world, first in India. And over time, through capitalism, through that economic activity, they gained more and more economic leverage in India, that they then gained more and more political leverage in India, that they then suddenly reached a point where they were able to act completely in their self-interest and do whatever they wanted without any consequence to them, only consequence to other people. And then they transformed from a company into an imperial power. And they did that all with full backing of the British crown, of the state, of the state-based empire. And eventually, like, the state then benefits by nationalizing the British East India Company. And that's when India officially becomes a colony of the British Empire. But before then, there was like a couple hundred years in which it's actually a company that is ruling the subcontinent of India. And so I think we're literally seeing this play out again, where we first have companies that are trying to extend and create these economic financial partnerships, like, hey, you rub my back, I'll rub yours. You invest some money in my data centers, I'll invest some money in your data centers. But then as their tentacles reach further and further, the U.S. government is also making its maneuvers to ride on that wave and expand its empire as well. So once you see that picture happening, I mean, it is extraordinarily alarming because we are at a point now where the supposed leader of democracy, of the democratic world order, has decided now that's no longer the game to play. And this quest for AGI is oiling the wheels for this to happen faster and faster.
One of the people of those many dozens that you did speak to that would not speak to you was Sam Altman, the CEO, of course, and founder of OpenAI. I want to talk just a little bit about his kind of unique personality and the fact that it's him leading this charge. You talk at one point about the fact that so many around him are unnerved by his, quote, self-serving pursuit of power and his compulsive dishonesty. But he's also an extraordinary operator and just this incredible ability to really move in those halls of power. You go back in time, you talk a little bit about how he laid out a vision even early on that he wanted to be close to policymakers, to presidents, that he wanted to be a source of, quote, answers when they need to make big decisions. He's setting himself up very much as this kind of person who is shoulder to shoulder with the world's leaders and has the answers to their problems.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he is a once in a generation storytelling talent, and he's an incredibly strategic mind. He plays the long game. So he is able to do all these things also because he has a very good grasp of what people want. So when he gets into a room with someone, he's able to negotiate incredible deals with them because he will portray some kind of vision of the future that they want to be a part of based on what they need to hear to then suddenly put down lots of money or put down their authority or whatever it is to be part of that future, to have a piece of that future. And he also, as you alluded to, he also has a loose relationship with the truth, which is part of why he's such a powerful storyteller. He's able to spin stories irrespective of whether they have much bearing on reality. And that is what has allowed him great success and also has led to just a trail of controversy in his wake. And throughout the book, I explore how different people slowly come to the conclusion that he is manipulating them. And what I realized over time talking with so many people, some of whom, you know, love him, some of whom hate him, is that if you believe or if you align with his view of the world and his vision, what he's trying to accomplish in that moment, he is the greatest asset ever to have in your corner because he will persuade whoever needs to be persuaded. He will rally whatever capital needs to be rallied to do that thing. And if you disagree with him and his worldview, then he's the greatest threat ever because now you are up against one of the most powerful narrators of the future ever. And you have to somehow convince everyone else not to fall into that trap. And so all of those skills, I think, particularly position him well to entrench relationships with people in politics because politicians are also inherently run on stories and he's very attuned to the you rub my back and I rub yours dynamic of politics as well. So that's part of the reason why he's been able to rise higher and higher. And also part of the reason why many employees within OpenAI or other people in his orbit have a huge loyalty to him because they think if they attach themselves to him, they will also be richly rewarded.
And the book is replete with your interviews and interactions with other key OpenAI executives, Greg Brockman, Ilya Sutskever, many others. But I want to maybe step away from the commanding heights and maybe down to a little closer to the earth. Some of the other people you talk to for the book, people like Moffat Ikenyi in Kenya, a person who worked for the outsource firm Sama. He was at one point working with a quota of looking at 15,000 pieces of content a month on the sexual content team, essentially reviewing material that was coming out of OpenAI's products and helping to annotate it and classify it, presumably so that OpenAI could prevent that type of material from emerging from its models. What did you learn talking to Moffat and other people like him who were literally doing the in the trenches work of making these models that Sam Altman is selling at such a high level, making them work?
Philosophically, empire is about hierarchy. It's about this belief that there is a group of people who are superior, either because it's their God-given right or it's their nature-given right. And therefore, they get to rule over people that are inferior. And if you want to talk about that aspect of empire, going to talk with people like Moffat during the course of my reporting just hammered home how deeply hierarchical this world order that these companies have created is. Because, like, why is it that, so, like, Moffat's experience, he was working for this third party, as you said, Sama, and Sama gets a call or an email from OpenAI at some point saying, we want to give you this contract to build a content moderation filter for our models, because they were, at the time, OpenAI was just starting to think about creating not just research models, but consumer products off of their research models. And they thought, if we're going to have a text generation machine that can talk about anything, we really shouldn't be putting that into the hands of consumers and having it spew all kinds of toxic hate speech and all the bad things on the internet that it was ultimately being trained on. And so the best way to make this into a consumer success or business success rides on the ability to contain the toxicity of the model. And so they wanted to create this content moderation filter. They end up finding the outsourcing firm. And then Sama brings in all of these Kenyan workers like Moffat, like Alex Kaidero, who I don't write about in the book, but was another worker that I interviewed to do this work. And what they were doing was day in and day out reading some of the most horrific text that you can find on the internet, and also some of the most horrific texts that could be dreamed up by AI models themselves, because OpenAI was prompting AI models to come up with all of these different variations of horrific scenarios to give to the workers so that they could have a breadth of examples of everything that they wanted to filter out of the systems. And so those workers were then reading that and then putting it into a taxonomy of, is this violent content or sexual content? Is this graphically violent content? Is this sexual content abusive? Does that abuse involve children? And so it requires them to read the whole thing in detail and catalog everything. And just like content moderators in the social media era, it completely broke them. It broke them. It broke the people who depended on them. So in the book, Moffat had a family. He had a wife. He had a stepdaughter. And as he completely started to lose his sense of self from doing this work, his wife left him and took the stepdaughter with her. There is no clear reason why a company like OpenAI categorizes their researchers as doing the real work, being paid million-dollar compensation packages, and why they categorize someone like Moffat as doing work that is only worth $2 an hour. There's actually no, it's a purely ideological, subjective reason why you would categorize it that way. And so essentially what these AI companies do is they have this deep-rooted hierarchy about their superiority and others' inferiority. And this idea, like when I first wrote this piece for the front page of the Wall Street Journal, and OpenAI did engage with it, that the piece at the time, and gave me back a comment saying, this is what is necessary to achieve our mission of being beneficial for humanity. And I was like, okay, so now the question is, who do you define as having humanity? And so that was one of the reasons why I ended up highlighting these stories in the book of people that were feeling the brunt of the current AI development paradigm far and away from Silicon Valley, because that is when you really start to see the logic of the empire.
There's stories of that human impact. Another impact you get into is the environmental one. This takes you to a lot of places, but you spend time in Chile. You talk to activists there, including Tanya Rodriguez, others working on issues around kind of water and water resources, but also rare earths and other types of minerals and metals that are necessary for AI development, AI infrastructure. What did you learn in Chile?
There's these massive pieces of computing infrastructure that are going up all around the world to support the scaling paradigm of AI development that Silicon Valley has captured the public's imagination with for what AI can be. And that computing infrastructure, it hits different depending on what community it's in. Like in the US, most data centers go into rural communities, and those rural communities have a lot less economic power or political power than these companies by far, and have a really hard time pushing back or even knowing in the first place that these data centers are coming. They have no ability to assert and push back and ask questions or get any transparency on these pieces of infrastructure. It gets even worse when you're talking about a rural community in a global South country that has itself far less political and economic power than the US. And so when I went to Chile, what I learned was the extent to which these companies can really become exploitative and extractive to a new level. I was speaking with activists who had been fighting for years against this Google data center project. And the reason they initially started fighting was because they had long been water activists and environmental activists. And they discovered that this Google data center in the middle of a historic drought in Chile were going to come into their community to take one of the only sources of public water in the entire country. Because Chile has a really interesting history in that it was under dictatorship for a long time. And during that dictatorship, almost all things public were privatized, including water. But there was this one community that did happen to have a public water source that served the residents of that community, and in emergency situations also served water to the rest of the country. And that's where Google wanted to add its data center and then tap into that freshwater resource to cool its data centers. And the amount of water that they were proposing was to consume more than 1,000 times the amount of water that residents in that community would typically consume. And they went through, they like fought tooth and nail just to get Google's attention, because they not only had to make enough noise to pressure Google Chile, they had to make enough noise to then get that all the way back to headquarters in Mountain View. And one of the things that I describe is how Google's headquarters then sends people to Chile to meet with them to try and quiet the resistance. And they send people who only speak English, not Spanish. And so there's so many power dynamics at play here, where just to try and protect a life-sustaining resource in their city, they have to go through an extraordinary number of hurdles to even get Google to come to the table so that they can have a conversation. And then it turns out they can't because there's this language barrier. So yeah, that was one thing that I learned. But the other thing that I learned that was really amazing was the fact that these activists, you would think that they would have every reason to feel a complete lack of agency, and yet they have so much agency and they are continuing to fight even years later. And they're continuing to mobilize the community. They like go out and hand out pamphlets and flyers, and they have community meetings, and they're really working hard, and all of this under volunteer. And it was a really beautiful moment where I was like, oh yeah, this is how democracy actually works. This is how hard people need to fight all around the world to continue exercising their democratic rights and making sure that it's not taken away from them.
And I know you and I both share a fascination with these data center fights, how they play out in local communities, and the extent to which people are expressing various concerns about the future of their community, the future of artificial intelligence, the future of the economy, the impacts on the environment. I want to ask you though, a little bit, in this country, in the United States right now, we're seeing a kind of about face on the idea that we should do really anything other than help these companies advance. A lot of that seems based on various promises that the executives make. You point out one in particular, this idea that we have to develop artificial general intelligence, advanced AI, in order to resolve climate change before AI data centers and all the energy necessary actually exacerbates it. So that seems to be one of the key narratives. Another one is around supremacy with regard to China. We've got to beat the Chinese. Eric Schmidt, you know, just the other day at a House hearing, raised the frightening specter that everyone in a few years would have an Einstein in their pocket. But what if that Einstein spoke Chinese, which I found to be quite a thing to say? What do you make of the about face, the turn in American politics? Even this possible moratorium that's being considered in Congress at the moment on state AI regulation. And we really appear to be ready to simply, I don't know, clear the decks.
I really think it goes back to the U.S. government now having its own imperial ambitions. And they see these companies as the ones that they can send out into the world, the missionaries that they can send out in the world to help them establish these relations that continue to build the U.S. empire. And so that's why they are saying, don't get in these companies' way. Don't. Because this is our state asset to continue our expansion. And it's the fact that I think we've talked about this in previous episodes too, like this what about China card that Silicon Valley has just been able to pull out so effectively again and again and again. If you look at the track record of what this argument has gotten us, it has just gotten us more authoritarianism in the world. Like these companies are techno-authoritarians, and instead of actually having sensible legislation and regulation that allowed them to actually be providers of more democratic technology platforms and services, it's actually just enabled them to be a completely authoritarian in their own right. The world now has no example of any technology that has been developed in a kind of more democratic mindset, embodying democratic values. And to go back to what you were saying with OpenAI for countries and them saying in their blog post, we want to build democratic AI rails all around the world. What democratic AI? Like, I have not seen any evidence down to the way that these companies enter into communities and completely hijack the democratic process, all the way up to the way that Silicon Valley is now hijacking the federal democratic process. Like, where is the democratic part of this enterprise?
A lot of cognitive dissonance between these terms and what's actually happening in the world, between democracy and abundance. That's another term that you bring up. I think even in your dedication, you write that the book is to the movements around the world who refuse dispossession in the name of abundance. I wanted to ask you about that word. There's another exciting book out that lots of people are reading that deals with this word abundance. There are others who use it, maybe coming from even different political events. This is the goal, right? This is Sam Altman's word, very much. What does this word even mean?
It's a great question. What does it mean? There is a sort of vagueness about it, a purposeful vagueness about it, I think, in the way that Altman uses it and used it in kind of reference to the way that the tech industry evokes this hand-wavy idea that there will be more for everyone. And, like, Altman had this blog called The Intelligence Age earlier this year or late last year, where he said, we are now entering the intelligence age where the things that we will see enabled by AGI will be so extraordinary that we cannot even imagine it now. And it will bring us so much abundance and prosperity that we can't even describe it in language that we have today. And that was basically what I was referencing in the dedication was, do not let this rhetoric about we will bring you untold riches to facilitate the exact opposite, to take away your economic opportunity, to take away your resources, your natural resources within your country, to take away your water, to take away your future and your ability to self-determine in that future. So yeah, that was ultimately what I meant.
There are so many different things that are happening in the real world at the real moment that we're in that I want to ask you about. One of the things I'm really struck by right now as well that you do get to in the book a bit is the fact that so much of what we would need scientifically to know whether artificial intelligence is quote unquote democratic or just or simply not wretchedly biased to do any of the kind of safety testing necessary, the type of transparency, the type of science that's necessary. We seem to be closing that down in the US, which seems to be another thing that the government is doing, which is in many ways useful to the industry, but may ultimately, I don't know, shoot us in the foot. So much of the strength of American innovation in the past has come out of places like the NSF and the work of entities like NIST. But I don't know, are you following these developments? What do you make of them in the context of what you've written here?
Yeah, I think they're all evidence that a lot of the democratic processes, institutions that we previously thought were actually quite strong and would last a long time are being dismantled and crumbling because they get in the way of what the US government now wants to do. And that is very alarming in its own right. But I think it also points to, people used to say, what's the solution? I always be like, oh, regulation at the federal level. And all of this activity has made clear that is not the answer. That we cannot rely on any kind of top-down leadership. There is a crisis of leadership at the top, but that doesn't mean that we do not have leadership at the bottom. And one of the beautiful things of democracy is the fact that you can lead from the bottom. And I think as we think about what to do next, how to contain the empire, as I like to say, we really need to start being creative about building coalitions, building movements from the bottom up to apply pressure and demand changes from the way that these companies operate and ultimately the way that our elected officials operate. And we can't like waste time. Like, it's not a lot. There's so much work that we can do even when there is no leadership at the top. And it, just in the same way that Trump himself bided his time for 4 years and then came out the gate with just an extraordinary acceleration of activity to dismantle everything, this is the moment when we also need to do the work that not only starts to create pressure already on these empires of AI, but also sets us up such that when there is leadership at the top again, like there is a foundation for them to act.
You end this book with organizers, with people working from the ground, with Maori people, data workers in Africa. You call for a redistribution of power. Transparency is part of that. But I assume that's what you're getting at here, this need to take power from those who are in the leadership of firms like an OpenAI or in perhaps governments like the United States and put more power in the hands of those individuals. Are there any other more concrete ways that you can think we get to that world?
I started thinking about the AI supply chain, like data, computational resources, labor, models, applications, and each of these different stages or each of these inputs, these ingredients that go into AI, those are sites of democratic contestation where Silicon Valley has done a really good job of creating norms in which people, the average person now feels like Silicon Valley owns these resources, they own the data, they own these the land for the data centers, but actually everyone else does. Like, we own our own data. We own the land and the energy and the water that they want to use, and we own our own labor. To me, the concrete things that we need to do to redistribute power is, for example, by resisting the amount of data that we just willingly give up to them without any kind of compensation or benefit back to us. And we're already seeing lots of examples of that. Artists and writers that are suing these companies, the Hollywood writers that organized and mobilized one of the longest strikes in history to assert their workers' rights. The artists that are also glazing their portfolios before they put them online so that when AI models train on their work, they start to degrade. We are seeing, just as in Chile with those activists resisting the data center development by Google, we are seeing that all around the world with all different kinds of people that are rising up to protect their communities and demand these companies actually give them something that is actually beneficial to their communities in return for hosting a data center there. And I think I don't have all of the specific recommendations for what everyone needs to be doing at each part in each of these sites of contestation. When you think about what you can do, this is the framework to think about. What are all of the different levers that you can grab, all of the ingredients that these companies need, all of the industries in which they're deploying? Like, how can you actually push back and say, no, we don't want your vision. Here's the vision that we want as a public, as our community. And ultimately, if there's enough of that collective pushback and collective articulation of what we want for that future, I think that is the best hope that we have to move to a better world in the future.
This book is Empire of AI, Dreams and Nightmares. Karen, is there a dream that you can share with us? Is there a future that you imagine? Are there contours of that future you can describe if we are able to make some of the changes and reforms and perhaps come to some of the same conclusions that you've come to in this book? What does the future look like for you?
My dream is that everyone is able to live a dignified life. And that means they have opportunity to access education, opportunity to access affordable healthcare, opportunity to do fulfilling work and be compensated for it. And ultimately, there are many ways that AI can fit into that picture and help bring us to that future, but certainly not the version of AI that Silicon Valley sells to us, not the version that requires us to capitulate all of these rights towards some kind of ambiguous future. So my dream is that we remember what we truly need as people to live in a sustainable, equitable, functioning, healthy society, and then we figure out how to build technology to assist that.
If you want to learn some more ways about perhaps how to think about this problem, about how to advance some of the ideas that Karen's just addressed, perhaps you should pick up Empire of AI, Dreams and Nightmares in Sam Altman's OpenAI, which is on sale now. Karen, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Justin.
That's it for this episode. I hope you'll send your feedback. You could write to me at justin@techpolicy.press. Thanks to Karen Howe. Thanks to my co-founder, Brian Jones. And thank you for listening.
Tech Policy Press.